Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. All nine justices will participate in the decisions today, but two are unavoidably absent from the oral arguments. We have only two clauses remaining on the docket. In the order in which they'll be presented, they are XL Insurance Company Limited and ACE Insurance Company Bermuda Limited versus the Honorable James McCaffey, an original mandamus proceeding, and Temple Fortson Worthy versus Collagen Corporation from Dallas County. We've allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. We'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of the two arguments. These items are being taped by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a copy of the tape by making application with the clerk. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of argument time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. The court is ready to hear argument from relator in XL versus Mahaffey.
May it please the court. My name is Kevin DuBose, and I represent XL Insurance Company and ACE Insurance Company, the relators in this mandamus proceeding. The trial court abused its discretion by denying my client the benefits of an arbitration clause in their insurance policies issued to Bristol-Myers Squibb Corporation, or BMS. Those insurance policies were brought into this litigation, not by the insurer, BMS, and not by the insurers, XL and ACE, because they both realized their disputes had to be arbitrated. Instead, they were brought in by what is now equivalent to a third-party action filed by four defendants, who we will refer to as the Hartford defendants, in a cause of action for contribution. Now, even though it's a contribution action brought by Hartford, that contribution action is absolutely dependent on, derivative of, and limited by the insurance policy between XL and ACE and BMS.
Is that true as to the bad faith claims?
It is, Your Honor. This court has determined that extra contractual claims, such as a bad faith claim, if they are factually intertwined with the insurance policy, it is still derivative and it's still bound by that policy.
Is there a intertwining of the bad faith claims against the Hartford Group and the XL Group? Or are they necessarily different?
They are. The bad faith allegations against Hartford are different from the, if there are any bad faith allegations, are different from any that might exist against XL and ACE. They are the bad faith contribution claim, if there is such a thing, and we don't think there is, against XL and ACE is factually intertwined with XL and ACE's obligations under the policy. That's what's factually intertwined. As a matter of fact, the only bad faith allegation in BMS's cause of action against 71 different insurance companies is a failure to provide a defense and a failure to provide coverage. There are no independent bad acts alleged against anybody by anybody.
You're saying there cannot be contribution in a bad faith suit against multiple insurers with different policies?
We think that's right, Your Honor.
Is law on that, or is that just a common sense argument?
This court has not directly addressed that question. There are two courts of appeals decisions that have addressed that, Garcia versus APIE and Stewart Title versus Sterling, which are both cases that this court reversed on other grounds. But in those courts of appeals opinion, they ruled there's no contribution action for bad faith or 2121 cause of action.
Mr. DuBose, you said the bad faith allegations are a failure to provide a defense, and what was the other?
And failure to provide coverage.
Does it make any difference that XL and ACE or ACE are excess carriers?
They're not only excess carriers, Your Honor, but they're also indemnity-only providers. So they do not have an obligation to provide a defense ever.
Right.
They're also, because they're excess carriers, whether their obligation is triggered is also an issue. That's
right. And so the and their failure to pay, I guess, or to provide coverage is ordinarily an excess carrier's duty to pay is contingent on exhaustion, I guess, of the primary limits. And has that occurred here?
That's not entirely clear, Your Honor. In some of the years, that may be true, but there is some doubt about whether that's true.
Well, is there any doubt that the bad faith allegations are addressed to XL and ACE?
Well, they're
limited to failure to provide a defense and failure to provide coverage, and it's unclear that the primary limits have been exhausted so as to trigger the excess coverage. Is it unclear whether there are bad faith allegations against those excess carriers?
There are not bad faith allegations against them. BMS has not sued them at all in the underlying litigation and has not made any bad faith allegations against them. You have BMS making this claim against 71 insurers for failure to provide coverage and defense, and then four of those insurers have filed this contribution action.
On what basis would they be joint? Be a contribution if there are no bad faith allegations against the excess carriers?
That's our point exactly, that you can't be jointly and severally liable for contribution for a bad faith claim when there's no allegation of bad faith against XL and X. Now this litigation is at this
point. Well, has the briefs indicate that no arbitration has started yet? Is that still the
That's true, Ron.
Have any papers been filed so the issues have been framed in the arbitrations?
They have not, and let me explain that a little bit. We don't have any desire to get to arbitrate against Hartford. We don't feel like we have any claim against Hartford and are not seeking to compel Hartford to come to the table. That's one of the options that Hartford has. We have not begun...
I thought it was Hartford that might be taking advantage of the arbitration clause against you.
Well, Hartford has filed the suit against. They haven't sought arbitration against us, and we have said that's one of the options that you have. You can either choose to litigate the case with the judgment reduction clause, or you can arbitrate against us. In any case, we shouldn't.
But how about Bristol Myers? Have they sought? I didn't really mean Hartford. Bristol Myers sought arbitration.
Bristol Myers and Ace and XL have not yet begun arbitration proceedings.
If Bristol Myers didn't want to, could Hartford force it to, or in essence, arbitrate Bristol Myers' claims?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Could Hartford force Bristol Myers to arbitrate?
Yes. Suppose Bristol Myers doesn't want to arbitrate for some reason, or is reluctant to do so. Can Hartford, who is entitled to pro rata contribution at some point, if there's liability by XL to Bristol Myers, can they force Bristol Myers to arbitrate or arbitrate in Bristol Myers' stead?
I'm not sure if they could force Bristol Myers to. They certainly could arbitrate in Bristol Myers' stead because the policy says any disputes under this policy are subject to arbitration, and that would include the dispute raised by Hartford. So Hartford could certainly force arbitration.
So if they said, we now would like to arbitrate XL's liability to Bristol Myers, XL wouldn't object to that.
That's right, Trent. This court in the last 5 years has established a strong tradition in favor of arbitration agreements. In Anglin versus Tips, in Prudential versus Marshall, and in Easy Palm versus Mancias, this court has consistently held that there is both a strong state policy and a strong federal policy favoring arbitration agreements.
We've never had a case where a non-signatory would be compelled to arbitrate. Could your opponents try to distinguish all the New York and federal cases where non-signatories have been required to arbitrate? Would you respond to their attempt to distinguish those out of contention?
Yes, Your Honor. As this court has held, whether a case is a dispute is subject to arbitration is determined by federal law. And the federal circuit court opinions have consistently held that there is no privity requirement and one need not be a signatory in order to be bound. There are some federal circuit cases where the courts have held under certain circumstances that a non-signatory may not be bound, but the courts have consistently held that the fact that you didn't sign is not a barrier to enforcing an arbitration agreement. Perhaps the most interesting of those cases is the Barraclough versus Kidder-Peabody case out of the Third Circuit, which is cited in our brief. That case involved a former employee of a stock brokerage firm who had signed an agreement with the New York Stock Exchange in order to become licensed as a broker, which said any disputes concerning his employment should be resolved by arbitration. He later was accused of some misdoing, was discharged from his job, and he and his beneficiaries later sought to recover benefits of a pension plan that Kidder Peabody had invested on his behalf. That case involved a dispute not only between the former employee, but also his beneficiaries, who did not sign the arbitration agreement, and Kidder Peabody, who did not sign the arbitration agreement, because the agreement was between the employee and the New York Stock Exchange. And yet the Third Circuit held that that was still a dispute about his employment, and it was governed by that contract, and the arbitration clause would apply, even though neither party asserting rights was a signatory to the agreement.
If this has been your position consistently all along, how come there's a condition of, in at least one of these policies, the ACE policy, that talks about Bristol-Myers' obligations to try to help protect you in the event indemnity or contribution claims are brought in a lawsuit against your client?
That's called the judgment reduction clause, Your Honor, and that is set forth in under tab 2 of the oral argument exhibit that I placed before you under the blue cover. That judgment reduction clause, well, first of all, the policy when it comes to arbitration begins by saying any dispute under this policy shall be resolved by arbitration. And that's our primary position. But it also acknowledges that there may be third-party other insurers, such as Hartford, who may disregard that option and elect to enforce their rights through litigation anyway. And what that judgment reduction clause says is that when that happens, if they file an action for contribution, then the insured, BMS, will do everything under its power to get that dismissed, including, which they have done in this case, they should file a written declaration that whatever amounts the court should decide ought to be paid in contribution by XL and ACE will be reduced from the BMS judgment against other insurers. So that Hartford has the right to litigate its reduction of the BMS judgment. And let's be clear that that's all they could ever get through their contribution action. They could never recover any additional monies from XL and ACE. All they could do is reduce the judgment that they have to pay against BMS. And this judgment reduction clause, and particularly BMS's exercise under it of filing this written declaration, BMS has said, if you want to get a trial court declaration of how much XL and ACE would have owed by contribution, you can do that and we will reduce our judgment by that amount. So the BMS doesn't get the benefit of that part of the judgment. But the amount that XL and ACE actually pay to BMS is still determined by arbitration. So that way, XL and ACE's right to arbitration, to arbitrate their obligation, is still preserved. But at the same time, if Hartford chooses not to exercise the arbitration alternative, but to litigate its contribution claim, it can still do that, and its rights are fully protected. So that Hartford gets, through the judgment reduction clause, everything that they could possibly get in their contribution action.
So why are we here?
That's a good question, Your Honor. We're here because Hartford, whether they don't understand the judgment reduction clause or don't like it, they are insisting that they litigate their contribution clause and get a contribution judgment against XL and ACE, which not only affects the amount that they do not have to pay, but also affects the amount that we have to pay. And the policies clearly say the amount we have to pay, we get to resolve by arbitration. And it's because they don't want to recognize that right in us is the reason that we're here.
Well, you go ahead and arbitrate then and get your part out of the way.
Your Honor, I mean, in all fairness, the BMS and XLNAs have been talking. And it may be that they can resolve their dispute by means other than arbitration. They may never have to go through formal arbitration proceedings. But if they decide they can't work out their differences, that is where they would eventually end up, rather than in the trial court.
The better point here is that the trial court refused to stay Hartford's contribution litigation, or alternative refused to dismiss it.
That's right.
While using what? Arbitrate?
Well, it should be dismissed because we no longer have any place in this litigation. The judgment reduction clause completely protects Hartford. There's nothing, there's no reason for us to be in this litigation. We are giving Hartford the opportunity to litigate their contribution claim without us and to use the empty chair.
Is refusal to dismiss a mandamusable issue?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. In several cases, this court has specifically in BWI Companies versus Beck and Home Club versus Barlow. And I didn't mean to say this court. Those are both Court of Appeals cases. But they have held that a refusal of a motion to dismiss or abate, which is exactly what we have in this case, those are mandamusable decisions. Both the Austin Court of Appeals, Justice Smith, and the San Antonio Court of Appeals, those cases are both from the 90s, have held the refusal to dismiss or abate proceedings pending arbitration when there's a right to arbitrate under the Federal Arbitration Act. That is subject
but
to
those mandamus. But don't you assert this valuable right? You have not exercised it as yet. For how many months?
I think these cross actions have been on file for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I'm not clear about the dates.
Is it conceivable that you could have already arbitrated and got the answer to your question before they ever go to trial on their claim?
That's true, Your Honor. As I said, we had been talking, and we may not ever need to arbitrate. But if we...
And is mandamus an equitable proceeding?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Galloway, to present argument from respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeff Galloway. I represent the Hartford insurers, real parties in interest here. I'd like to start by addressing a few of the points that the court directed to Mr. DeBose a moment ago. Let me start with the mandamusable point. We dispute that this is a properly mandamusable order. In essence, what we have here is an order, a motion to dismiss has been denied. This court has repeatedly held that motions to dismiss, whether properly or improperly denied, are not subject to mandamus. We've cited in our briefs the Canadian helicopter case and the Bell helicopter case. I can take a moment. In particular, I would point to the Canadian helicopter case where there had been a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction and it had been denied. And this court said, CHL, the complaining party, points to the inconvenience and loss of time and other non-pecuniary resources that it will suffer by having to go through an entire trial before it can obtain review of the trial court's order on appeal. However, such factors do not distinguish an erroneous refusal to dismiss a cause for lack of personal jurisdiction from an erroneous refusal to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, which in the Bell helicopter case this court had held was also not mandamus.
On the other hand, we said in England that if you're denied the benefits of arbitration, that is subject to mandamus, and why if the motion to dismiss or abate is coupled with a intention to proceed through arbitration, why didn't that change the result to be more like Amlin rather than Canadian helicopters?
Well, because the last element is not present here, Your Honor. What Amlin said and what Amlin dealt with was a denial of a motion to compel. And Amlin dealt with the narrow circumstance of where arbitration had been sought under the Federal Arbitration Act. And because of the peculiar wording of the Texas Interlocutory Appeal Statute, which did permit interlocutory appeal of a denial of a motion to compel if arbitration had been sought under the Texas Act, it would not, there was no appellate jurisdiction because of the specific reference to the Texas Act for federal court arguments. So the parties there had a right to be here on their Texas arguments already, And it only made sense to the court, and it makes common sense, why split up the review and require final judgment review of the federal arguments where interlocutory review of the state arguments were available. We don't have that here. If there's no mandamus, this case doesn't belong here at all. There is no comparable state aspect order that is subject to interlocutory appeal. Now, Ace and Excel have in fact asserted, they've filed a writ of error, a petition for a writ of error, where they do assert appellate jurisdiction. And I understand that proceeding is not on here, rather. But their argument for appellate jurisdiction is defective on its face. The two types of orders for which interlocutory review with respect to arbitration is permitted are simply a denial of a motion to compel and an order granting a stay of an action of a loss of an arbitration. We don't have either one of those here. So absent mandamus, these parties wouldn't be here in the first instance. That's how Anglin is distinguished. To permit mandamus here would essentially gut the interlocutory appeal statute. The legislature made a judgment as to the types of arbitration orders that adversely affect arbitration for which interlocutory appeal would be permitted, and the two that I just mentioned. To simply say, well, any order adversely affecting arbitration, we're going to allow mandamus, well, why have the interlocutory appeal statute?
This is a subject of the Federal Arbitration Act applies here, doesn't it?
It probably does, yes.
There's no interlocutory appeal on state court practice for denial of federal arbitration, is there?
No, there is not.
The only way you can get here is by mandamus.
That's right. But it's the same type of action. This precise issue was addressed by I believe it's the Dallas Court of Appeals in the Batten v. Green case, which we cite in our brief, where there the parties had sought appeal of a denial of a motion to compel, and they argued that the Federal Arbitration Act, I'm sorry, it wasn't a denial of a motion to compel, it was a denial of a stay or a motion to dismiss. And they had sought appellate jurisdiction in the Batten v. Green case. And there they argued, well, under the Federal Arbitration Act, there is the federal statute that permits interlocutory appeal of a granting of a motion to stay, I'm sorry, a denial of a motion to stay, and therefore we should have appellate jurisdiction here. And the court said, no. This is not one of the two types of orders that are permitted. And we're not going to extend the appellate jurisdiction simply because this is under the federal act.
Would you respond to Mr. Bose's argument that the Faraclough versus Kidder Peabody case compels the decision on our part that a non-signatory to an arbitration provision is subject to arbitration?
Yes, that's a husband and wife and children type of case. In that particular case, it's true that there was an arbitration agreement signed only by the husband and father. And the court quite sensibly held that if the wife and the children could essentially assert the same claims, loss of income from the husband in a lawsuit, why have an arbitration clause? They were literally standing in his shoes. This is an entirely different situation than we have here. And in fact, I'd like to back up a moment and address some of the kinds of cross-claims, because I think there was a few inaccurate statements with respect to particularly the tort claims. This is not, Hartford is exactly the same type of insurer that Ace and XL are. We are excess policies, we are indemnity policies as well. To the extent that we have bad faith or tort liability to Bristol-Myers, it is of the exact same type of policy with respect to indemnity and duty to defend and so forth that Ace and XL have. Now, it's uncomfortable for me to address bad faith because we vigorously dispute whether there is any bad faith liability here. But our, to the extent that there is bad faith liability, the types of things alleged against my client are exactly the types of things that Ace and XL did as well.
Let me ask you, you're touching on this issue. To get contribution, it's got to be joint, several liability.
Yes.
And Hartford has to pay more than it otherwise owes.
Right.
Right? Now, how can Hartford be saddled with a judgment under the facts of this case for more than what it owes?
the easiest way to see that would be under the contract-type claims. Bristol-Myers has alleged that this is a continuous injury case underneath it all, and that each policy, in effect, from we haven't discussed it here this morning, but this is the breast implant, underlying cases of the breast implant cases. Bristol-Myers has taken the position that each policy from date of implant to date of suit is triggered, and that under its view of allocation, trigger and allocation law, it may seek full recovery from any insurance policy in it from that time period from date of implant to date of suit.
Now, That's on the contract claims only.
Now, our policies, my client's policies, are from 1982 to 1985. The ACE and XL policies are for policy periods 1990 through 1992. However, they cover injuries going back to 1986. They're claims made type policies going back to 1986. So under Bristol-Myers' allegations, an implant in, say, 1982 and a date of suit in the underlying claim of 1992, they can pick and choose. They can either submit the entire claim to my client, and my client is obliged to pay the full amount of that claim, or they could submit the entire claim to ACE or XL, and they can pay the full amount. And that's and indeed, the trial judge has ruled in its May 3rd order that this method of allocation is correct. We dispute it, and we expect to be back here before Your Honors in due course addressing trigger and allocation, but those issues are not before the court at this time. But in any event, the allegations in the underlying suit, and to date the trial court has ruled, that Bristol-Myers can pick and choose which policy to respond. In that event, if they pick us, as they have on some claims already, we will pay, we are obliged to pay the full amount of that claim. And this is a claim that under the same trigger and allocation theory, ACE and XL are also liable to pay the full amount of that same claim. And under the employer's casualty case cited in our brief, this is a classic contribution type situation and not an equitable subrogation situation. Equitable subrogation would come up in the circumstance where we're only liable for our pro rata share to begin with, and they're only liable for their pro rata share, and for whatever reason we pay more than our pro rata share to protect the interest of the insureds, miscalculator, whatever, we pay more. And under equitable subrogation, we're entitled to stand in Bristol's shoes and get back whatever we overpaid that would have been their obligation. Contribution is different. Contribution is where we're obliged in the first instance to pay 100%. They're obliged in the first instance to pay 100%. We've paid more, but nevertheless, it's unfair, equitably unfair, to saddle the entire loss on us. So after we've paid our 100%, we have a contribution right. And that distinction is completely ignored and obfuscated by ACE and XL's papers in their argument.
Are you saying that Bristol-Myers is not yet allocated or chosen whether to seek coverage under Hartford's policy under XL's or ACE's policy or any claim?
No, they have. They have submitted, we understand that we're in the course of litigation and their underlying claims are still coming in. But the position and Bristol-Myers has made payment demands of Hartford. Hartford has, in fact, paid these claims under a reservation of right, where 100% of, say, a 1982, well, actually, it's a better, our policies are layers stack up in various places, and the policies that have been implicated to date are in the 84-85 policy year. And so for implants that occurred in 1984, we have been required to pay 100% of those claims. This gets into, I know I don't have a right to respond, and I can anticipate some responses from ACE and XL, and so I'd like to perhaps anticipate some responses there. Their policies have a provision which states that, in effect, they're taking the position that in a continuous injury context, their policies will only cover injuries that occur 100% after the retroactive date, which is 1986. So they will take the position, I anticipate, certainly they've taken it with Bristol-Myers, that a 1984 implant that caused any injury during my policy period is simply not covered under their policies. Well, unfortunately for us, and perhaps unfortunately for them, the trigger and allocation rulings in the underlying suit that apply to my clients are being governed under a determination that as a matter of law, injury occurs at date of implant. Their policies contain a New York choice of law clause, and the position of ACE and Excel has been, and I took the ACE claims people's deposition a few weeks ago, is that they follow the injury in fact trigger. And so even if there is a 1984 implant, they will look to the medical records and find out when this person is actually injured. And we know from being involved in the underlying cases that typically the first symptoms follow some number of years. So we would anticipate that the typical 1984 implant claim, where as a matter of law we are saddled with that injury under the rulings in this case, if you apply the injury in fact trigger, which their policies require, and look at the medical records, you will find that they are in fact not injured, or there's at least no evidence of any injury until after 1986. So under their policies, they would be responsible for 100% of the claim. Under our policies, as the existing rulings exist right now in the underlying case, we would be responsible for the 100% of the claim, and therefore we'd be in a contribution situation entitled to equitable contribution, and we don't stand in their shoes, and they've cited no authority that could bind us to an arbitration clause in this circumstance.
Let me ask you a question. You're going to win or lose on your contract as to whether or not there's coverage, right?
Yes.
And then you'll be liable for the amount of coverage to the extent that they're injured up to that coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? Now, your policy provides that if they have another insurance agreement that covers this period of time, that your coverage will be reduced pro rata based on the amount of the other coverage?
No,
so
we've
got two policies that cover the same period, same injuries, and so Hartford takes it. You've got a policy that permits Hartford to discount from its liability to Bristol-Myers for this other coverage that's out there.
No, our other insurance clause, and I'm virtually certain that the ACE and Excel other insurance clause is what's known as an excess other insurance clause. Our clause says that our policy is excess to any other available insurance. Theirs says the same thing. What that means in law and application is an issue that has not been explicitly addressed by the trial court in our case.
You talk as though you assume that you have the right to equitable contribution. I'm just trying to figure it out. You have an obligation. Contribution occurs when you've got this joint and several liability issue.
Yes.
Seems to me it's dependent on this joint liability circumstance. You have an obligation to cover 100% of their damages that are covered by your policy. That's your obligation.
Yes.
Now, for this period of time, is it conceded that when your policy has an obligation to cover 100% of the damages, that until you, in fact, well, I don't know, what gives Hartford, if it doesn't have a contractual right to reduce what it owes based on a pro rata share, what provision does it give Hartford to step in the shoes of BMS and sue BMS's other insurer to try and claim some money from them?
It's not a policy provision in this circumstance. It's equity. It's equitable contribution. That if we have...
Where's the equity here?
The equity is that it would be unfair that if they have an obligation to pay 100% and we have an obligation to pay 100%, and beyond our control, the insured comes to us and say, I pick you, I want my 100% out of you, why should we be saddled with 100%? And that's what the employer's casualty case really addresses, although it addresses it in the context of subrogation, where the parties in the first instance only had a pro rata obligation. I wish we only had a pro rata obligation, and I expect to be back here in a year or so arguing that that is in fact all we have. But the fact of the matter is Bristol-Myers alleges a joint and several obligation. The court has so held at the trial level. And at this stage, our contribution claims are governed by the allegations. Contribution claims are always necessarily contingent upon the validity of the underlying claims.
Assuming then, based on what you're saying, is really we would be allowed to go contribution against them because we think they are liable, like we're liable. Of course, you have to look, they're only liable to Bristol-Myers by way of arbitration. So why aren't you subject to awaiting or predicating your contribution issue on the arbitration, if any, that exists between Bristol-Myers? Because that's the only way Bristol-Myers is going to attach liability this other carrier is by way of arbitration. So why isn't Hartford bound to await its contribution claim on that arbitration?
Because our contribution rights are direct rights founded in equity. I would agree that the substance of whether they are covered under the policies, you have to find out, is there an insurance policy, is there coverage? But the procedures by which those rights are established, I don't see why we should be compelled to follow their same procedures.
Because that's the only way that Bristol-Myers attaches liability to XL is by way of arbitration.
If we stood in their shoes in a subrogation, if we were suing in their right, then I would agree with you 100%. We're not standing in their shoes. This issue was somewhat indirectly addressed in the American Centennial case, where this court actually addressed it in an equitable subrogation context. That case, as you may recall, was an excess insurer versus a primary insurer, finding that the primary insurer had an obligation, put it backwards, it was a Stowers-type case where the primary insurer failed to settle within its policy limits. There was a final judgment above the limits. The insurer didn't care because he had excess insurance. And so the issue was, can the excess insurer sue the primary for this Stowers-type situation? And this court, in that instance, in fact found that the claim was based on equitable subrogation, but specifically noted that there is a distinction between an equitable subrogation-type claim and a direct right. And the distinction being, you stand in your shoes and you're subject to all the defenses and policy conditions and so forth. It found equitable subrogation in that narrow circumstance, saying it doesn't matter in this particular case because there aren't any policy defenses, and we'll leave to another day whether or not the true theory of recovery is a direct one or not. The direct theory of recovery is, as stated in the employer's case, is one of contribution. It's a direct action. It's not a subrogation standing in the shoes action, and it's the type of claim that we have because it is alleged that we were jointly and severally liable.
Any other? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. DuBose, you said that Bristol-Myers and XL and ACE are in negotiations and that ultimately there may be no arbitration.
That's true.
If that happens, can you still, is it your position you can still compel Hartford to arbitrate its contribution claim?
If it seeks contribution based on our policy, which it is doing, that must be resolved by arbitration. That's true.
What does your operative petition say against Hartford and the other 70, the 71 people you sued? For what claims do you seek joint and several liability?
First of all, we haven't sued anybody. It's BMS that has sued the 71.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Bristol-Myers Squibb's case against the 71 insurers, what are they claiming?
All that it claims is a failure to defend and a failure to provide coverage. Now, it expresses that in several different variations. It calls it Article 21, 21.
But then you seek several types of damages for that.
That's
not
true.
Not only whatever they're entitled to under the POC, they allege they're entitled to under the POC, but also bad faith.
That's right.
Those types of damages. And does it, apparently from the briefs, it seeks joint and several recovery from those 71 defendants as to at least some of those claims. Does it seek those claims?
That's true, Your Honor. They have made no bad faith allegations against XL and ACE. Hartford.
Well, then apparently there's no paper that we know of against XL and ACE at this time from the BMS, right?
That's right, because they understand their value.
I'm asking about the other 71. They seek joint and several recovery as to all the types of damages they seek from all the different claims.
That's true, Your Honor. They have broad pleadings trying to get as much as they can possibly get. We don't think they're entitled to joint and several liability for bad faith, because bad faith is something unique, conduct unique to a particular defendant. And short of some kind of conspiracy theory where they got together and jointly participated in bad faith, I can't conceive of circumstances under which insurers in this kind of situation would be jointly and severally liable.
Is there a single injury?
Yes. There's a, I mean, it's
It has to be partial. If more than one person is liable for the single injury under a bad faith theory of cause of action, how do you parse that out as between the various defendants?
That would be something that the fact finder would have to do, depending on the circumstances and the allegations of bad faith. But what we have now are just a general allegation against all defendants that each of them exercised bad faith.
Are there general allegations of a conspiracy or anything?
No.
Well, how can there be a single injury among 71 companies who had different policies covering the many instances different years?
Well, perhaps I misspoke. It is a single type of injury. I suppose they would say that with each insurer, there is a separate act of bad faith. But again, they have not alleged particular acts of bad faith other than the failure to provide coverage and the failure to provide a defense.
What damages have they alleged over and above denial of the policy proceeds?
They haven't alleged specific damages. They've just said, we seek damages and we're not just limited to the policy proceeds. But there's no specific allegations other than that.
Well, I guess there's no claim for mental anguish between these parties. What kind of other damages is in the realm of possibility?
I can't imagine.
Other than the policy proceeds.
I can't imagine it. Like I said, they put in general language saying we're not limited to that so that they can get as much as possible.
Do they sue for punitive damages?
No, they didn't, Your Honor.
If the claim is just for policy proceeds, would there be any right to contribution as joint tortfeasors under these circumstances?
I don't see how they could be, Your Honor. And that's our point. That sorry, my time. We don't understand how. I mean, there is no real equitable right of contribution in Texas. Contribution is statutory and it's contractual. So any right to contribution would be wrapped up in the contract. In order to sue under the contract, they stand in the shoes of the beneficiary of the contract and are bound by the same arbitration clause the BMS would be bound by.
But to return to an earlier question, should it be determined in an arbitration between XL and Bristol Myers that XL have some liability under its policy, could there remain issues as between the pro rata contribution to those claims that then would be litigated, not arbitrated, between Hartford and XL?
That's Hartford's option. They have the right to arbitrate them. They can litigate that in the trial court. But again, what that does in the trial court is it reduces the amount that they have to pay, that Hartford has to pay. But the amount that XL and ACE are obligated to pay BMS is something that's resolved by arbitration.
Well, but issues like equitable subrogation and how it works in this case would not be covered by the arbitration.
I'm not sure why that's true, Your Honor.
Would only the coverage issues be covered by the arbitration agreement?
Well,
so even if it is determined that XL owes this for these kinds of claims under these kinds of circumstances, if Bristol Myers then turns around and says to Hartford, you pay us, and Hartford wants something out of you, then they could, in those circumstances, they would have a cross-claim or not.
Well, even that claim would still be factually intertwined with the policy. Any rights that they have are going to be determined, as they admitted in oral argument, they're determined by the contract. And so if the rights are determined by the contract, then the arbitration clause applies.
So your position is any dispute that exists now that you've surfaced so far as between you and Hartford has to be arbitrated?
That's right, Your Honor.
In Louisiana, where there's direct action, opportunities for those who suffer from, who claim a wrong against a person who has an insurance policy, do you say these arbitration clauses would force those types of claims to go into arbitration as well?
If
you can't answer that simply, don't. I'm just trying to
think
how far you're going to carry what's bound by it.
If the rights under the cross claim or the third party claim are determined by the contract, then the arbitration clause applies.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the arguments in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.